And hello, here we are again, Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, and on the web at KUCI.org. We're broadcasting from the campus of the University of California, Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. Today, my guest is Nuala O'Fuaylon. She is author of Are You Somebody?, a memoir, and My Dream of You, a novel, both New York Times bestsellers and notable books. Her newest release is Almost There, published by Riverhead Books. She lives in the west of Ireland, in New York City, and is at work on her second novel. Hi, Nuala.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on.
Thank you.
I love your work, and your memoir, Almost There, is so, not only is the writing superb, but you put yourself in such a vulnerable position in the way you reveal so much of yourself and your life. And, we can talk about that later, how the difficulty or ease of doing that, but will you...
I can say at once that I completely agree with you. I don't know how I fell into the high-risk business of being a serial memoirist, more or less, you know, particularly in ripe middle age. I mean, I wrote my first memoir when I was 56, and this latest one is 6 years later. So I've really taken it up at the age, I think, when perhaps one begins to become reckless. But it is true that... you're putting yourself out there to be judged, and, you know, reviewers and so on, they can't go on about whether the writing or the art is good or bad. In the end, the reviews are reviews of yourself and your life.
Yeah.
So it's extremely dangerous thing to do. I've only come to realize that lately.
Hmm. Well, will you tell a bit about this current book, Almost There, The Onward Journey of a Dublin Woman, for those readers who may not have seen it?
Yeah, of course I will. The point is that I was in my late 50s and a very sad and disappointed person when the only thing I had going for me at that point was that I'd a very good job in Dublin. I was an opinion columnist with the Irish Times newspaper. This was 6.5 years ago, okay? And... writing an opinion column in a newspaper is a kind of male thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a man's job. So you have some status in society. You're not just a kind of yet another middle-aged woman. And a small publisher asked whether they could collect some of the opinion columns. And I offered to write an introduction to the collection of opinion columns. And I was convinced that nobody would ever read this because nobody does read old opinion columns. But I took the chance while I was writing the introduction to more or less look back at my life by myself. Nobody knew I was doing it. And I sat at the kitchen table and I wrote the story of my own life as an introduction to the old opinion columns because I had a chance to publish, and at the same time I was safe because I didn't think I'd have more than a handful of readers. So the introduction got out into the world, and I thought that that would be the end of that. But instead, it found its audience. It became as a book called Are You Somebody?, that introduction became a phenomenon almost in Ireland because nobody had written a very candid woman's story until that point. And then it crept across the Atlantic and somehow found its audience here in the United States. And it was such an amazing thing to happen to a depressed, near-alcoholic, more or less broken-hearted and lonely woman, which is what I was. I had no partner, no child, no money, no plans in particular back then. And now, 6.5 years later, all that's changed. And so... among the motives for writing Almost There was simply to tell the Cinderella story and to explain how it happened and the little events that pushed it along, not because I'm so obsessed with my own story, but to show that we're full of potential at every part of our lives and wonderful things can and do happen, and that there is absolutely no need to do what I thought I was going to do in middle age, which is to kind of withdraw from life and give up hope. There's hope all the time, and I wanted to say that.
And almost there, you say something to the effect of that you had never stopped to think about what writing a memoir that people would actually read would mean.
No, I never did. I was writing to myself, you see. I had posed to myself the question, what was your life for if it has come to nothing? And I was living in a house by myself with very little human contact, and I'd been like that for some years. And I'd forgotten the reality of other people. I'd forgotten that the people I mentioned in the memoir, for example, would be more or less bound to read it. For example, I gave a description of when I was a young woman, 20. I had this kind of boyfriend, and I was fooling around on a bed with him one night, and there was a knock on the door, and he went out to answer it, and it was a telegram for him, and it told him that his mother had died. And he came back into the room, and without telling me that that's what it was or what had happened, he sort of fell upon me and, to my mind, more or less raped me. So I described this in my memoir, and never dreaming that, of course, that man exists. And it turned out he was living, in fact, in L.A., and he somehow heard about this obscure Irish book, and he contacted me, and funnily enough, he'd written a novel in which he had described the same episode, the girl on the bed, the mother. But, of course, far from it being him forcing himself on me, in his version, I forced myself on him in a misguided attempt to console him. So it's like, do you remember the movie Rashomon, that everybody sees the same event from a different point of view? That happens when you write a memoir. You know, your family say, that's not what happened at all, Nuala, and they, you know, they tell you it was different, and even though you would swear on your mother's grave that you know, that you're being entirely accurate. And also people hear what you think of them, and it affects your whole life to write a memoir. I didn't realize that. I didn't realize what an incredibly dangerous thing it is to do.
When you were writing this, or at any point, did you worry about what your family, you have quite a large family apparently, and did you worry about what they would think or feel once they saw it, or did you think they would never see it?
Well, they don't habitually use, you know, read my journalism. They never mention it or anything. But I did sort of go to the elder sisters, the ones around my age, to say that I was kind of writing about the past and our mother and father, because I had to do some dealings with them, you know what I mean? I couldn't just land it on them when I'm in contact with them all the time. And two of them I did show early drafts to. But, you see, they have their own ways of keeping me in my place. For example, my elder sister, with whom I'm on perfectly good terms, and, you know, I collaborate with her about my old aunt and all that, she has never mentioned, "Are you somebody?" to me. And she said about three words about this latest one. And another sister, who I thought was my close friend in the family, I sent her a proof copy of Almost There a few months ago, and she hasn't replied. And, you know, the fact is that those silences are hostile, you know. I don't quite know what they mean, obviously. They could mean a range of things, but they're all bad things. Because the truth of the matter is that one should never do that to another human being. There's always something you can say. And yet, you see, it was me that committed the first aggression on the family by writing in the first place. So they're entitled to do that to me. They're entitled not to be bullied by me into a reaction. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So interesting. If you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Nuala O'Fuaillean, author of Almost There, The Onward Journey of a Dublin Woman, published by Riverhead Books. Will you read to us?
Oh, will I?
Yeah.
Okay. Though I never do readings because, you know, I think only people, you know, with a certain flair, add anything to what they write by reading.
You have such a wonderful voice, though. You could read anything and it would sound wonderful.
That's very nice of you. I'll read a little bit about home. It's in the context that just recently with the bit of money I made and so on, and because we were all now getting on in years, I suggested to some of the sisters and a brother that we all went off to Italy for a week, because we'd never, you know, been anywhere. And although we're shy of each other and so on, they did go. We did go, nine of us. And I'm interested, very interested in middle age, and I point out in the book that to do something like that for the first time is wonderfully double-faced, because you can only do it because you're getting on in years. In other words, it's an autumnal thing. And yet, because we'd never done it before, it was spring-like, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And now I'll read you a page, okay?
Yes.
It was something that we were meeting, because we are the remnant of a family who never went on a family holiday, nor even a family outing, not even once, and for whom every shared meal was perilous. Violent, even, if you count getting drunk as a form of violence, or standing up to leave the table while everyone else is still eating. The festive Christmas dinner was particularly tense, because getting that many components ready under pressure made my mother hopelessly nervous, and she had a drink very early. And spending a whole day and evening at home made my father feel trapped. But the occasion was not simply tense. The same meals that both parents showed they didn't want to share with each other or with us were often surrounded by pleasant little rituals. On Christmas morning, whatever number of us there were at the time, lined up in reverse order of age, so that the youngest was first, outside the room where the presents were piled under the Christmas tree. And my father opened a bottle of champagne very, very slowly to build up the suspense around the cork going pop. And everyone, even the baby, was given a drop of bubbly to make a toast. And at the meal, each person had to tell a joke. My mother never understood jokes, so there'd be a fond joke about my mother not understanding jokes. But the good humor was a precarious state. My father's deepest instinct was to charm, and there was almost nothing he couldn't make charming. But a lot of the time she would have none of it. She was embittered by the need for plain speaking. What money did he have? Did he have a mistress? When was he going to do something about whichever of the children was in trouble at the time? Which offended him, of course, and he'd glance at his watch and say, sorry, but he had to go, instinctively heading for an audience more appreciative than he got at home. But sometimes, for maybe an hour at most, our mother and our father would have appeased each other. And she, without knowing it, had her own gauche charm, more powerful, if less supple, than his. Then it was a great pleasure for all of us to be together. You could glimpse what we might have been.
Beautiful. You have been listening to Nulo Fuelen read from Almost There. That's gorgeous. And I want to say that Almost There is a gem for readers of any age. But I think especially in the culture, the current local immediate culture I live in here in Southern California, there is such an emphasis on, youth and that if, you know, even I think writers here sometimes get caught in the myth that if they haven't made it by a certain young age, they never will. And this is such an inspirational, your life is inspirational, really, at your success later in life. And I wonder if you ever, in your wildest dreams, expected it.
No, I did not. I mean, when I was young, I had absolutely no picture of the rest of my life. I bounced and reacted from one thing to the other, and I barely clung on because I was extremely poor, and I drank too much. So, although I was very intelligent in an academic kind of way, I kept falling out of the educational system. I was expelled from school. I was even expelled from university for unbecoming behavior. And I kept landing back down, you know, like snakes and ladders. I'd get up a ladder again and then I'd go down a snake again because I was wild and I didn't know what I was doing. And through the kindness of others, I just about got through and I ended up doing a postgraduate degree at Oxford, and then I became a university lecturer, and gradually I appeared to settle down as a member of the middle classes, but I was always self-destructive as well. For example, in the 60s, I was really addicted to sleeping tablets, barbiturate sleeping tablets that I didn't know were barbiturates or anything. I just knew that I had to have them. And I was also constantly picking the wrong people to have relationships with. Well, I didn't pick them. They seemed to pick me. And so I just wambled on through life. And you know, I was in a very, very bad way by the time I was 40. And then I began to live with a woman after many years of being with men. And she was a wonderful woman. And we were together for 14 years. And I got strong and healthy with her. And then that relationship, too, broke down. So that was when I gave up hope of ever being any good at a relationship. That was when I decided that my life, which had had its great flashes of promise, had come to nothing. And it was at that lowest point, the darkest moment before the dawn, that I took the opportunity to look back on my life and write about it in a spirit of melancholy and of farewell. And then it turned out that there are thousands of people out there who understood what I was writing about. And so I acquired a little celebrity, a little money, and a great many friends. They may be strangers, but they're friends in the sense that they know what I'm talking about.
Yes. You say something, you have a line or two in this book that is... It's wonderful. I'm going to read it. It's sort of a quarter of the way in. You say, I am surprised that more memoirists don't become serial memoirists because it is a precious thing to be allowed to talk about yourself in public, not for reasons of simple exhibitionism, but because the attempt to describe your experience to an audience pushes you forward into an understanding of it.
Yes.
Would you elaborate on that?
Well, I think that at that point I was talking about my brother who killed himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he killed himself grotesquely and slowly by saying that he was going to drink himself to death, and he sat down in a chair, and it took him several months. But he did. He refused to eat or to see a doctor or anything, and he did die. And the attempt to describe what it was like for the first of my siblings to go, and to go that way, and to go that way, in my view, because he was so neglected by his mother and father. And to have to say goodbye to his poor body, all that, it helped enormously to have to try to find the words for it. Because I think that words do process experience. And I pity people who are, let's say, immigrants, who still have not mastered the host language.
Mm.
Because bad things that happen to them, they can't explain and they can't display the range of their feelings. And no wonder they rage sometimes and become violent sometimes. Words are an alternative to violence and an alternative to self-hurt. And my chance to write not one but two accounts of parts of my life, you know, has been an agent of salvation for me.
Hmm. You've written a novel and you're working on another, and I wonder how that is for you. What is the difference between writing a memoir and writing fiction? And do they help or hinder the other going back and forth?
Oh, I think that having been a journalist hinders fiction writing. I mean, I'm attacked by incredulity all the time, you know, thinking, what am I doing, a grown woman sitting here making stories up? Because, of course, fact has always been your bulwark against your own ego. I mean, you know, if you have to write an article for a newspaper on, say, global warming, it's an impersonal act. And you're kept in check by fact. But in a novel, you can kill people off, you can get them, bring them perfect lovers, you can do anything. And it stymies me, that feeling that it's just child's play.
Mm.
So I wish that the culture would allow me to just issue an autobiography every few years, you know, like Maya Angelou or someone. But it won't, so I've got to try and get another novel out somehow, even though I'm terribly stuck.
Oh, that's funny. I can't imagine you stuck.
But... Oh, I'm stuck.
You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Nuala O'Phelan, who is author, best-selling author of Are You Somebody, and author of the current book, Almost There, The Onward Journey of a Dublin Woman, published by Riverhead Books. Well, what do you do when you're stuck? I mean, you probably have a contract, and so you have to come unstuck.
Oh, not only have I a contract, I've had it for far too long. They have to keep changing the, you know, the delivery date, because mm-hmm. I haven't it done. And I took the money up front, and I have a brother who, like the dead one, is an alcoholic. And he was living in a room in England. I felt very bad about that. So with the money, I bought him a little house in Dublin. And he's sitting in the house in Dublin as happy as a clam, drinking away, while I desperately struggle to complete a decent novel. And one of the reasons I wrote Almost There is because my editor, who had just rejected what I'd written, said that one of the things wrong with my novel was that it was full of undigested lumps of autobiography. And it seemed a good idea to write another autobiography to get rid of those lumps so as to free the novel. Hmm. But so far that hasn't happened.
Can you ever get rid of all the lumps of autobiography? I mean, I would think more just keeps coming up. I don't know.
Or... Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, I'm an amateur at this game, you know.
Oh, that's funny. Well, you have these true. Wonderful books, these wonderfully successful books. But what's the difference between being a writer in Ireland and being a writer in America? Is there a difference?
Well, yeah. Well, oh, yeah. There are so many more models of successful writing in Ireland. And there's so many more, in America. And there's so many more women in America. So many great 19th century and 20th century women writers. In Ireland, it's almost impossible to think of a well-known woman writer apart from Edna O'Brien.
Mm-hmm.
And the men totally dominate. You know, Joyce, Yeats, Shaw,
yes.
Beckett, Seamus Heaney, you know, it's man, 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 and like everything else in Ireland, of course. So America is infinitely more hospitable to a woman, and also America is far more hospitable to confessional writing like I've been doing. It's the home of daytime television and of people bearing their souls. People don't do that in Ireland, and they certainly don't do that in England, the home of the stiff upper lip. So in all kinds of ways, America has been wonderfully congenial for me. And I also came here to write the novel because in Ireland, it's very difficult as a middle-aged woman to believe in yourself because, you know, you've only got to where you've got by sort of apologizing and clinging on and so on. But in America... America's full of people who came here with the intention of achieving things that they couldn't achieve in the place they came from. And so America is full of energy and hope and belief that you can transform yourself. And without that, I could not have written a novel. I took a room in Greenwich Village. I got a cat out of a cat rescue place. I sat there on and off for 2 years, and I wrote a novel when I was nearly 60. And that I owe that to America.
Hmm. Does writing fiction and nonfiction, do they come from two different places for you? Or is it all in the same pool and you're extracting what you need from each?
Oh, I think it's all in the same pool. But I know very little about the conscious process of it all. I only know that there's the occasional picture in my head that I have... enough desire to form into words that I'll bear the sitting all day, every day at my table, you know, looking at the laptop. And, you know, it's very, very tedious and boring writing. And the difference between writers and people who want to write is that the writers actually sit there and stick it out. You know?
Yeah, that does seem to be a major difference.
Yeah.
The glamour of writing goes out the window when you have to sit down and work on it.
Yeah, this is the glamour of writing. Going around trying to sell the book, talking to people like you, you know, being allowed further license to talk about myself. This is the payoff. And I love the bookstore events I do because I get something back from the people who come.
Mm-hmm.
But for that, you pay in years and years of sitting... in some room forcing yourself to stick with it. And in my case, by the way, compulsively eating. You know, I nibble all the time as I try to choose words. And since I began writing, I just get plumper and plumper. Isn't that awful? I wish I could still smoke. Yeah.
Oh, dear. You are listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Nuala O'Fuilan, author of Almost There. And usually at this point we take a break, but because we have basketball airing in about 15 minutes, I think if we could, I'd love to just keep you on the line for a bit more and skip our break and just chat a little bit more about your work. And curious as well, I wonder how your life changed when Are You Somebody became an immediate success. I mean, how did that affect you and your writing?
Well, it was meant to be just a once-off. You know, it was just meant to be a snuck-out introduction. It wasn't meant to make any difference, you see. I went on working in the Irish Times. Indeed, I moved to Belfast in Northern Ireland to write from there. Nothing much happened to me except that I was a lot more famous in Ireland than I had been and that I had made a difference to some lives. But I just went on as before. I still had no partner. I still had no personal life, you know. And indeed, that went on for years, even through the writing of the novel and the success of the novel, until about a year ago. And about a year ago, as part of my struggle with the second novel, I was trying to describe my heroine, you know, the way in a novel you've got to drop in clues to so the reader will know what your heroine looks like and, you know, what age she is and what her hair is like and all that. And then somebody told me about computer dating and that you can put a profile of yourself on a computer and the computer dating thing will find you a match. So I thought, I'll get my heroine to do that, because if my heroine describes herself, then I'm not going to need to put in all those clues. You see what I mean? And by the way, no writer out there is to steal that idea. I've copyrighted it. So I sent away to the computer dating place for the rules of the profile. And when I got them, I wrote one for my heroine, you know, in my manuscript, in my novel. In other words, my heroine, made her go on computer dating and describe herself.
Mm-hmm.
So I loved doing that. And then, of course, I was messing around once I had discovered all this, because writers will do anything rather than write. And I started reading all the guys and everything. And after about a month, I got involved myself. And if you like, I'll read you
Yes. A
couple of pages.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
I would love it.
In real life, I idly posted a profile of myself on Match.com. I really do think it was idle. I wasn't seriously looking for a partner, and certainly not for one who was reduced to using a dating agency, internet or no internet. Those were for the inadequate or for adventurers. The reason I think it was a genuinely idle action is because I've looked at my profile, and it is obvious that I was making no effort to sell myself. What I said was, cheerful, shy inside, usually self-sufficient but would love some tenderness. I'm 57, Irish, a bit plump. I love listening and talking, animals, music, food, wine, and kissing. And I didn't send in a photo. I didn't mean those words. I was not 57. I was 61, as anyone could see. I said 57 because I hated being of an age that began with the word 60. So since I'd never have to defend the lie or try to get away with it, I'd rather lie. This plump, shy persona, by the word. I am more than a bit plump. I am very plump. I don't particularly love listening. Loving kissing was a disgracefully coy way of intimating that I had relished sex with the few people I'd really loved. I dashed off these approximations, but I hesitated as to whether to put in the one incontestable fact that I'm Irish. Irish is a double-edged sword. Lots of people groan at the thought of the Irish, including lots of the Irish. For whatever reason, there were no replies. None. Match.com probably has hundreds of thousands of subscribers, and you'd think someone would have been interested in me, but no, not one person was. And it got worse. The computer kept offering me profiles of men around my age, and I looked at them with interest. Of course, my profile should have read, "Woman writer will do anything to distract herself from task of writing a second novel, including playing with Match.com." One day I saw an interesting one among all the guys whose hobbies were going to vintage motorbike rallies and whose favorite meals were steak. This one was from a man in Brooklyn who said he was a lawyer who had been an academic sociologist and who was knowledgeable about Italy. He'd studied housing policy in Venice, he mentioned, and I'd just been in the Venice area with the family on our second Italian holiday, and I wanted to know something about the real town behind the tourist facade. He said he was separated and looked after his daughter, aged 8, half the time. The photo showed a balding, bright-eyed man with a wide, sensitive mouth in a heart-shaped face as lively as an elf's. So though he appeared to be wearing the most terrible Aran cardigan, I sent my profile to this man, whose name was John. He didn't reply. That's hitting rock bottom, to have overcome all your inhibitions about electronic dating and then not even get an answer from the one man you might possibly be persuaded to condescend to talk to.
Mm. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Oh, you are so open and...
Oh, wait till the book comes out in Ireland. I'll be crucified. Nobody in Ireland would admit to going on computer dating. They just wouldn't, because they would see it as such a terrible loss of face. Hmm. But, of course, one of the great glories of middle age is that you care less and less about face. I mean, time's running out and the hell with the begrudges, you know.
Are there special qualities of a person, a writer who is a memoirist? I mean, are there certain things that if you look back, you could see that you were going to become a memoirist someday, even when you were writing, you know, writing for the Irish newspaper, even in your journalism career, could you see that you were headed this way?
Absolutely not. But now that I'm doing it, kind of, it seems to me to have something to do with the difficulties of my childhood and the fact that I was watchful. I didn't feel loved, so I was very alert to what was going on. And I think that that instituted a distance between myself and experience, and that other people live less self-consciously than I do. It's not a question that I'm a phony, but it's just that I'm very burdened by consciousness, and I think memoirists must be, because for one thing, they have enormously good memories, and for another, they remember how they were in a situation and how the situation was, and lots of people don't remember things very well.
Would you keep a journal? Had you kept a journal through your life that refer to?
Oh, no, I hadn't, no. Hmm. When I first got involved with this, I had an old steamer trunk upstairs, and the key had been lost for more than 25 years. And I went upstairs, and I knocked it off the high shelf it was on. It was a wooden trunk, and it split open. And inside there were a lot of letters and photos from when I was a young woman. And those were clues. Hmm. And, of course, if they'd been from a different era in my life, the life story would have been different, because It's almost random, you know, what way you do shape it. It's not more truthful than a fiction, a life story.
Yes. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I wonder if you have any advice for the writers listening who perhaps find themselves working on a memoir or fiction, whatever they're writing, and they're needing some words of wisdom here.
Well, I think it's very good for a person to write an account of their life, even if it's only going to be, you know, self-posted on the internet or self-published, even if it's only going to be read by family and friends. I think it's a wonderful thing to do, both for yourself and for other people. And secondly, if it's a question of near professional writing, then I went on a writing course when I began, and the teacher said, when it's the Olympics and the athletes are in the starting blocks and they're about to run an Olympic race, they're not waiting for inspiration. Forget waiting for inspiration. Train. Write every day.
Hmm. Yes. Revisit your work before it forgets you.
Is that how it's put?
Well, yeah. That's what I've been thinking lately.
Oh, Barbara, yeah. Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, and I hope you'll come back when your novel comes out.
Oh, God, so do I. I hope my novel does come out. Can I just ask you, KECI.org, if I look that up on the internet, would I be able to hear this interview?
No, but I can send you a copy.
Ah, oh, it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. Live. It's live all
it's
over
live,
the world.
So that's the only way. All right. Thank you again, Barbara.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye.
That was Nuala O'Fuaillean, author of Almost There, The Onward Journey of a Dublin Woman, published by Riverhead Books. And she was speaking to us from San Francisco, where she is currently on book tour. She will be at Book Passage today, tonight, in Walnut Creek tomorrow at Barnes & Noble, and on the 15th at the Irish Arts Foundation in San Francisco. From there, she goes to Portland, to Seattle, and then on the 25th of March, she will be at NYU Ireland House in New York City. Wonderful book, Almost There. If you'd like to be on my weekly email list, email me at writersonwriting@earthlink.net or visit my website, writersonwriting.com. We're going to have basketball soon, so we're going to end early here. Let me just say that this is 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, California. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and thank you, as always, for listening.